From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Thursday edition of the Oxford Exxon Podcast. Chase Parham, Neil McCready. I am in Oxford. Neil remains in Atlanta. SEC Media Days ongoing, and we're going to continue our days of looking around the league, talking to media members from that cover other schools as well. A lot of those for you today here on the show. I'm not exactly sure what order they're going to be in, but you're going to get Will Salmon, former Clarion Ledger writer who covered Mississippi State, now covering Florida for The Athletic, the Arkansas media legend Bob Holt, Jason Caldwell, who covers Auburn, Scott Rabelais, who covers LSU, and then Josh Kendall, who covers South Carolina. So a run around the league today on the Oxford Exxon Podcast, the Oxford Exxon Highway 6 West in Oxford. Lunch specials $4.99, daiquiris as little as $3.99, as big as 44 ounces, and you go next door to Oxford Crystal and get pimento cheese bites. You get pimento cheese on your crystal if you so choose. People have tested them. They love them. You should try them too. And again, I am sitting this morning in the Clark Ford studio.
You are? I am not. But Clark Ford is in Amory, Mississippi, 662-257-1900. Call that number. Ask for Corey Clark. Tell Corey what new Ford you are looking for. He'll send you a quote within 15 minutes. In business hours, it's that simple. It's right to the bottom line. There's no haggling. It's really just an easy automotive purchasing experience. I've done it. You should give it a shot as well. So you get your quote, and then you can shop it around, or you can go ahead and let Corey and the people at Clark Ford take the hassle out of the everyday car buying experience. You get a great Ford product, phenomenal service after the sale, delivery options, all sorts of things. Corey will take care of you. That's just what he does. So at the end of your deal, we'll make it even better. Mention this podcast or any of our family of podcasts. It's $500 off. Already great bottom line at Clark Ford in Amory.
Nothing's really going on with Ole Miss in the last 24 hours, and we're looking all around the league today anyway. I see this on Yahoo. I completely missed this yesterday. Former Georgia players kind of going at Jeremy Pruitt. Did you follow much of this?
I caught wind of it, yeah. You know me, I think a lot of schools dodged a bullet on Pruitt, and maybe that's not the right way to say it, because I think a lot of schools did their due diligence on Pruitt and said, nah.
Well, this one's interesting to me because this is not guys that played for Georgia under Jeremy Pruitt. Aaron Murray got this thing started talking on a radio show out of Nashville, I think, yesterday. And then David Pollack, who typically is one to sort of play the nice guy, not really jump into many criticisms. He plays both sides, but he definitely backs Murray a little bit. I'll read the quotes here because I found this interesting. Yeah, we have not been proponents of Jeremy Pruitt being a success at Tennessee. Out of all the new coaches, I think we both believe that he's probably the most likely to fail out of this group. He reminds me a little of Ed Orgeron amongst other characteristics. And Aaron Murray, who again was gone before Pruitt was there as the defensive coordinator in 2014-15, says, quote, I don't know if his personality is fit to be a head coach. As a head coach, there's so many things that go into it. It's not just going out there and coaching. You have to deal with the front office. You've got to talk with the president of the university. You have to deal with boosters. You have to deal with the offense, the defense. It's not just going in there and dealing with kids and scheming up. There's a lot that goes into it. I don't think he's the right guy to be the CEO of a corporation. Pollack goes on to say, quote, he put on a good show at the main podium at SEC Media Days. He definitely showed you what he has. I want to see if he continues to treat people in the correct manner, if he respects authority. Because to be honest, the stories we've heard, we've all heard the same stories. It was pretty bad. It was disrespectful. So that's what I'm interested to see.
Yeah, it's the tame version. I mean, there's a story about that's widely spread about confrontations that he had with Mark Richt, both in the office and outside of the office at all sorts of times of day. And when you talk to people about Mark Richt isn't the confrontational type. So there's very little doubt as to who instigated those confrontations. I think Ole Miss went down the road on checking out Jeremy Pruitt. I know Mississippi State did. He was about Tennessee's 10th choice, and I talked to someone who covers the Tennessee program and has covered it for a very long time the other day about their search. And Pruitt was kind of, well, we're at the bottom of the barrel. And his personality is, as Aaron Murray described it, it's volatile. Being a head coach does not really allow for that sort of volatility. Have to change. Ain't changing is difficult. And then there is the presence of Phil Fulmer at all times around that program, and people who are around that program, who have known that program for a long time, believe that Phil Fulmer has some Barry Alvarez in him. And I think that's going to be a distraction for Pruitt. I think it's going to cause friction inside and around that program because they're not very good and they're going to lose games. And I think Phil Fulmer has an old school Tennessee worldview that is not realistic. And I think it's an absolute plane crash waiting to happen.
What's Fulmer's reputation and stuff up there right now?
I mean, his reputation, Chase, is that he's the guy that won a national championship at Tennessee.
Well, of course, but I mean, as an AD.
It's too early to say, but he walks the Tennessee football practice fields in the spring wearing his Tennessee coaching jacket.
Yeah.
That's not a good sign.
No, the former football head coach's AD is a really strange dynamic unless there's a specific personality in that role. I mean, you've got to be there is one path for that being correct, and it doesn't feel like Philip Fulmer has the ability to be that one path.
What's the name of the baseball coach at South Carolina?
Ray Tanner. Mark Kingston's the head coach. Tanner's the AD.
Imagine if Kingston is conducting a baseball practice in Columbia this fall. He's conducting a fall practice for whatever a fall practice may or may not be worth.
Okay.
And Ray Tanner shows up at the practice, Chase, in uniform, wearing his cap.
Number on the back, whatever it was he wore.
Is that a problem?
It would be a little odd look for everybody else. Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's enough of a distraction, quite frankly, if Ray Tanner shows up at the practice wearing a sport coat and a button-down and his slacks and no cap and sitting up 10 rows up the first base side.
Yeah.
But that's enough of a distraction right there because the man casts quite a shadow. But if he shows up, Chase, wearing his uniform, not going to go well. I mean, if you're Kingston – I mean, I promise you, you might not do it publicly, but it is not going to take long before you are in a quiet room somewhere with one of your trusted confidants and you say, what the was that? And that's the kind of thing that Pruitt's dealing with, and I don't know anything about Kingston, so I can't compare Pruitt to Kingston, but I'm going to guess that Kingston is not as volatile as Pruitt.
Yeah, so you have Fulmer acting like he does, Pruitt being the guy he is. It creates quite the situation for, as you said, volatility.
Yes, especially given the fact that that's not going to be a very good football team.
They're the car crash that I can't wait to watch. It's always kind of fun to watch Tennessee fail anyway. This takes another dynamic on how fun it might be.
Yeah, it's... There's two potentially very volatile storylines in the SEC, and that's one of them. Everything else is pretty nondescript, really, this season. I mean.
What's the other one?
LSU.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Tennessee, by the way, opens this season with West Virginia.
Could easily be a loss. Probably will be a loss.
Oh, I think it's a loss, yeah.
Yeah,
I'll be shocked if they're going to be 2-2. It's fun. It's an interesting schedule. So we hadn't really done this with Tennessee yet. This thing has a chance to go off the rails. I mean, easily in the first season, even though obviously nobody's going to criticize him completely for a first season. West Virginia to open. I think it's in Charlotte. It's a neutral site game.
0-1.
Okay. East Tennessee and UTEP, win-win. Okay.
Yeah.
2-1. And now here is a stretch in a row without a breather. There's a bye week, but I don't care about that. Florida at home. Huge game.
Got a real chance to be 2-2.
At Georgia.
2-3.
At Auburn.
2-4.
Alabama at home.
2-5.
At South Carolina.
2-6.
Woo. Here's the deal with that, though. 3-5 at best. Florida's the only toss-up in that. They're losing at South Carolina, they're losing at Auburn, and they're losing at home to Alabama.
Yes.
And now, look, they can win 4 in a row to finish. But at 2-6, that has a chance to fall off before you have the chance to go 4-0 to finish.
Give me the last four.
Charlotte at home.
Okay, it's wins.
Kentucky at home.
Should be a win, but
I didn't say would.
Yeah.
Missouri at home, probably a loss, honestly.
Yeah, frankly.
And at Vanderbilt,
probably a win.
3-1 though makes a lot of sense there. Either way, 5-7 though, 5-7.
Yeah, it's not bringing national prominence back to Knoxville.
Yeah, they're fascinating to me. I mean, West Virginia can set this thing off right on the start. It's a 2:30 national game on CBS.
Ooh, as I've said for a long time, and I mean this. We taped a very long nothing but college football for the people who want a serious college football show. We gave it to you, Greatest Pod in the South. It should be out sometime today with Brian Matthews and Jay Tate and myself. Nothing but college football, and I said it on that one, and I've said it on our show many times, and I know you agree because we've talked about it. Just because you were once a national power does not make you destined to always be a national power.
Oh, Notre Dame, Michigan, Tennessee, plenty of them.
Just because you've never been a national power doesn't mean you can't become a national power. It means it's harder, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. But just because you've been one doesn't mean you are ordained to stay one, or that even after a downtime, you will once again become one just by default, just by rolling your helmet out there. It's not how it works anymore. And all of the advantages that made Tennessee great in their glory days, and they absolutely had a glory days, no question. They had a, 10-year run where they were a national power. But in that run, it was pre-SEC network. A lot of programs around the country maybe weren't as committed to facilities and such as they were not as committed to recruiting nationally as they were. They had, at that time when they were a national power, they were probably more committed to facilities than most. They were on television every week. Not everybody else was. They were all over the country. Not everyone else was. They had a national brand. Not everyone else did. Kudos to them. But later, as we are today, everyone's on TV all the time. We talk about this all the time. If you want to watch Kentucky football every week, you can. You absolutely can. If you want to watch Ole Miss football on your screen or computer every week, you can. You don't have to miss a game. That wasn't the case in the glory days for Tennessee. And now everyone else is committed to facilities. Everyone else is throwing money into coaches and recruiting budgets and all of those things. So now you got to do it on your own strengths. And I would argue that Tennessee doesn't have a bunch of them. They're limited geographically. I know they have a big network, but you're up in Knoxville. I think it's hard to get a lot of kids to go there. It's a long way from anything. You don't have a huge recruiting base anywhere. I know the closest big city is Charlotte, Atlanta. Everyone else minds those same areas as well. I just think it's a really difficult job. And when you talk to Tennessee people, they'll tell you about tradition. I would argue with the modern kid, you don't have any tradition. And then I would argue when people say, well, they have this big stadium, it's fantastic. And Neyland, I was just at it a month ago. It is awesome. Neyland's cool. It's impressive. Kids, I've never heard a kid say, I'm going to school X because of their stadium. Never heard it.
Yeah, I mean, look, this thing comes full circle. The two things that you mentioned that stick out the most to me is, number one, these kids have no idea what you did in 1998, 99, or frankly, 2013. There's no historic value put on that for the most part.
And to finish that part of the point, I'm not interrupting you. Yeah. You're exactly right, but you left off a key part that would come after the comma. They don't know about it, comma, and they don't care.
No. And the other part, to bring it completely local as we go into this break, is you mentioned teams aren't always powers, SEC network. Well, that's leveled it on both ways. You've got to be efficient no matter who you are, because this is what we always talked about too. Ole Miss, Mississippi State, whomever, they can win national titles now too if you do it the right way, because things have evened up enough to make it where if you catch the right lightning in a bottle, you're efficient in the right ways, you run the program on a competitive level at that level, because you're already on that level. You've got SEC across your chest and they pay you $40 million a year. You can make it work. Well, as those teams and programs have caught up, that slack had to come out somewhere, and it's the former powers that no longer are efficient, no longer run their program in that way, and Tennessee is A1A and 1B of that example. So,
well, you mentioned Ole Miss and State. I mean, just real quick to put meat on the bones of your argument, you're exactly right. Mississippi State a few years ago was 10-0 going to Alabama. They were number one in the country in November, and that was a competitive game. If Mississippi State wins that game, and I know they didn't, but had they won that game and they were in position to have a chance to win that game, if they win that game, they show up in Oxford for the regular season finale as the top-ranked team in the country. That absolutely means you are playing in the national championship playoffs at that moment. We've talked about it more times than it's probably than it was worth talking about. If you changed 4th and 25 and nothing else, if everything else stays the same, and I have no idea whether it would have or wouldn't have, it's a real decent chance that Ole Miss is in a national semifinal game. To your point, everyone in the league sans Vanderbilt can at least dream about playing for a national championship, and it's not a complete fantasy. You have to be, like you said, at Ole Miss or State, do you have to be more efficient than you do at Alabama or Georgia? Yeah, of course. And anybody who won't admit that, you're delusional. But you can do it. It can be done. You've seen that happen in very, very recent days. Both Ole Miss and Mississippi State have gone into the month of November in the national title mix.
Yeah, I mean, Ole Miss and Mississippi State were both in the top four of the very first college football playoff rankings when they came out in October or November or whatever that was back in that year, I guess 2014. So,
yeah, and Mississippi State was number one in the country going into week 11.
Yeah,
They were right there in week 11. You can do it. It can be done.
We'll jump off with our interviews now. We'll lead off with Will Salmon covering Florida for The Athletic and then run through the rest of them on today's show. So hang around, get a look around the SEC as we continue. So we'll go to a break, then Will Salmon from The Athletic, now covering Florida. Take a break in this podcast. Tell you the name to know in Memphis real estate is Stacy Berry, a Keller Williams agent who's looking to help you find your special place to call home, whether it's downtown, midtown, Germantown, or Collierville. Keller Williams is the number one real estate agency in the world, number one in agents, units sold, and volume sold. And the Berry home team is now an integral part of that world-renowned brand. If you're a first-time home buyer looking to downsize, Stacy will evaluate and determine your current home value and sell it quickly for top dollar. So if you're looking to sell a home, buy a home, or invest in real estate, call the Berry home team today and let Stacy unlock Memphis for you. You can reach her at 901-481-6420. Stacy Lane Berry at KW.com. That's Stacy with an E, L-A-I-N-E, Berry at KW.com, or check it out, theberryhometeam.com. The podcast also brought to you by Mastercuts Lawn and Landscape, 662-607-6000. 7773 is the number to give MasterCuts a call and let them help you out, whether it's building an outdoor living area, outdoor kitchen area, or just take care of your yard all year long with weed eating, edging, and mowing. They do that for me all the time. They are excellent. And tell them you heard about them on the podcast. They might cut you a deal there as well. 662-607-7773. Podcast also brought to you by Locker Stockers. Take the hassle out of stocking your locker or your suite this football season. A new thing set up for to help you, the customer, really takes the hassle out of something that you might have to go and fit a time period, wait in line a little bit to get in. Instead, they handle the purchase and delivery of the locker or the products to the locker or suite before game day. They're also going to help give you an early sign-up special with a 10% discount on a season package if you sign up before August 1st. 662-586-1487 or email info@lockerstockers.com for information. And the podcast is also brought to you by Community Mortgage, Oxford, Memphis, Soto County, and Chattanooga. All underwriting and processing is done in Memphis. You're getting local underwriting and understand your market. A leader in condo financing and the float down option. So you can find Jason at 662-234-2704 or JLo at communitymtg.com. Now back to me and Neil.
Will Salmon of The Athletic, kind enough to join us here. First of all, congratulations on the gig. I knew about it for a while. I was actually able to keep a secret.
Yes, that was cool. But no, it is pretty cool to be introduced as The Athletic. I think that's like the first time that's happened, actually. I've done a couple of interviews, but not as The Athletic. It's kind of like, oh, now you're at The Athletic, huh? That sort of thing. So that was really cool. I'm proud to be there. It's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm excited for you. As I've told many people, I'm cheering for it. I'm pro journalism, and it's fun to see it go, and I hope it works out.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because I think if you have any interest in journalism doing well in the future, you should root for The Athletic, because what we're trying to do is just provide quality content across the board at a reasonable price. You know, I think right now we have a special of $2.99 a month, so that comes out to like $30 a year, $35 a year. It's really not that much of a splurge for people, for most people. I know like a lot of people have tight budgets or whatever they don't want to spend on sports journalism, but I mean, we are pumping out some good stuff, in my opinion. And it's quality. It takes time. There are no deadlines, so we're not strapped by sort of like the archaic journalism rules that should be long gone by now.
I know you're covering Florida, and I'm going to get to Florida in a second. You spent, as we taped this on Wednesday afternoon, you spent a good part of the day with Joe Moorhead at Mississippi State. I know you covered him a little bit before you took the new gig. What's he like? What do you anticipate him doing at Mississippi State? How will he be different than Dan Mullen?
Yeah, I think he's a great fit for Mississippi State for a couple of reasons. One, the personality fit. He's a guy who's from Pittsburgh originally, a blue-collar town. His dad was a steel mill worker, so he got paid, what, like slightly over $2.5 million a year. For him, that was awesome. Like, it's like one of the lowest-paid SEC jobs that there is in football. So for him, he loved it, and he thought the world of it. And I don't think he was BSing me or anything like that. He genuinely felt that way. And from on the field, you know, his offense is great. It's based on the RPOs. It's electric. He's going to take some deep shots, which is very different than Dan Mullen's spread offense, which you see a whole lot of, like, slants and, you know, option routes, stuff to the RBs. Moorhead's more about taking calculated risks. And for him, they're not so much as risk because they plan on them. And he looks to execute them. He practices them. It's not something that it's a roll of the dice when he's taking a deep shot down the field. It's something that they really believe in his offense.
You covered Nick Fitzgerald throughout his career. I always thought of him as a guy that was more dangerous with his feet. I know he could make throws, but I always thought what really, really hurt people was his feet and his legs. He's such a powerful runner. Does he have the arm talent to run the offense that Moorhead wants to run?
Yeah, that's going to be the biggest question. You know, it was interesting because Joe Moorhead said today, actually, he was asked, like, so what do you want out of completion percentage? And that's a question that Dan Mullen usually didn't really answer all that much. He would kind of say, well, it kind of depends on who it is, whatever. Moorhead said his threshold is like 65, which is pretty high considering Fitzgerald has to hit 60 first, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, he just hasn't been accurate. And then downfield, his throws of like 25 yards or more wasn't a great percentage either. But I'll say this. The receivers were so bad at Mississippi State last year, I'm hesitant to really judge him on that because those were some really bad receivers. And I know everybody has their own weaknesses, and a lot of teams in the SEC don't have a bevy of receivers to go to. But Mississippi State had a problem there last year, and they didn't have one guy, I think, get over like 400 yards receiving. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I'm a little bit hesitant because he was a high school kid who wasn't asked to throw the ball a lot out of high school, and so this is only going to be his, really his third year, but in a lot of ways it's been a combination of some valid reasons as to why his completion percentage isn't probably where it would be for a third-year guy.
So when you look at this State team, and we'll get to Ford, I promise, in a second. When you look at this State team, I think about their defensive line. Obviously, Simmons is a terrific player. They've got talent at linebacker. Their secondary is a little suspect at times, at least in my eyes. We talked about their offense. Yet people talk about this being potentially a 10-win team. Some people say, well, that's way too far. It's a 7-win team. You know their personnel better than most people I know. What do you think?
I think 9 wins is fine. I think 9 wins should be what the expectation is, actually. Probably closer to 8 than 10, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, that 8 to 9 range is probably where the expectation should be close, you know. And that 9 is the number that I say. Now, can they get more than 9? They can. But you got some games there that's going to be hard to win. And a lot of people say Florida is one of those games that they should win, and I agree. But, hey, Dan Mullen's going to look to win that himself at his former place against a big team in Mississippi State. It's a game that he's been marking on his calendar since he's left, probably. So while many want to chalk that up as a win for Mississippi State in Starkville, let's see how it goes. You know, that's one of those swing games for them.
I was going to ask you about that game. We talked about that on the podcast earlier in the week. I said, you know, that's a game that Dan Mullen, if he weren't the competitive guy that he is, could approach it with, hey, if I win, great. If I lose, here's what I'm going to say. I can use it as a marketing tool. He doesn't strike me as that type of guy, though. He reminds me a little bit more of, for your time probably, Tommy Tuberville, who I covered at Auburn. When he played Ole Miss the first time, he lost in overtime. And instead of saying, hey, see, I can recruit, it was anger. It got personal, vitriolic a little bit, which I think he probably later regretted. How do you think Dan Mullen will approach that game? And then along those lines, how do you think Mississippi State fans will approach Dan Mullen?
That's a great question, because I think Dan Mullen in his career, right, when he's first at Mississippi State, he's a little bombastic. You know, he has that big personality. Gets married, has some kids, kind of goes through life a little bit more, experiences some fallback, some blame for his micromanaging, you know, and blaming others and that sort of thing. And that comes back to bite him over time, slowly but surely. So he learns a little bit, in my opinion. But let's not get it twisted here. He's still pretty much very arrogant. You know, there's a certain level of arrogance about Dan Mullen that I think he would tell you. Because I truly believe it from covering him. That makes him what he is. That makes him good at his job. That's part of what makes him good.
Yeah.
It could hurt him, sure, but it also helps him. So I think that you're right. I think that at the end, it's going to be telling. I think it depends how they lose that game. I think it depends, because if it's like one of those games where it comes down to the wire and he's already drained out or whatever, he may let a couple of things slip. But then again, he may be like how he was at the Egg Bowl last year or against Alabama last year, where he was like, hey, you know, I've been in these type of games before, this or that, but again, this is going to be different. So it's very, very questionable how he will react to the outcome of that game. I know Mississippi State fans, there's a lot of animosity toward him right now because of not the fact so much that he left, I feel like, but just how he left. He kind of did like an Irish goodbye, where it was like, oh, you know, let me tweet out that I joined Florida without saying anything about Mississippi State first. And there was a lot of like things about that a lot of people don't know, where he may have tried to reach out to people at Mississippi State and maybe his message wasn't delivered. Who knows? You know, I know I've heard a couple of different stories about that. So, you know, I just know from the fans' point of view, that's what they think, is that he offered like an Irish goodbye about it and didn't say anything. But let it be known that he did publish a full-length letter in the Clarion Ledger thanking everybody for their support. And even at Media Days this week, he was very, very clear to say that I wouldn't be where I am without the people believing in me at Mississippi State in 2009.
You mentioned the Egg Bowl. I thought his comment this week was funny. He made a comment about being involved in healthy rivalries now, obviously referring to unhealthy rivalries at his previous job. A lot of Ole Miss people, as you know, have said, well, yeah, you're one of the reasons it was really unhealthy, which is fair. Were you surprised when he made that comment? And does, in your opinion, does he sort of know that, yeah, I did pour some gasoline on that fire?
No doubt. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit sometimes, but I always tend to think with Dan Mullen, he has some things that he's going to say in an answer to a question that, and I don't even know if he does it on purpose. I mean, you can't prove it, but he knows what he's getting at, and he's like in on the joke, if you will. You know what I mean? And the people who have covered him are in on the joke too, but not necessarily the people who are asking him the question, because he's going off of prior experiences. Maybe he did it for that question. Maybe he didn't. I think you and I think he probably did. I think part of him does, and I don't really blame him for doing that either, because you gotta remember, he was a northern New Hampshire guy coming into this territory where things are new to him, and I'm not trying to make excuses for his behavior or whatever, but I think he has always used that in his career, whether he was at Utah or wherever else, referring to the school as the school up north or the school over there. That was something he always did in his previous stops, and he brought that to Mississippi State. So, yeah, I think it's like one of those things where you sort of reflect back and, maybe that wasn't the most careful thing to do, or maybe he was too aggressive with pushing the envelope constantly with the rivalry.
Last thing, you haven't been at Florida long. I know you probably don't have an intimate knowledge of the roster and all that yet, but what has he inherited? How good is this Florida team? How much work does he have to do to catch Georgia?
Yeah, it's a pretty good team. They're one of the teams they're one of the top teams in the country in terms of returning production. So that gives them an edge going forward to be probably one of the most improved teams in the country. They got to be better than what they had been. So let's put that out there first,
sure.
Especially offensively. I mean, that was abysmal to watch. I rewatched all those games last year. I'm sitting there just waiting for it to end, like hoping to God it ends sooner than what the time says it will end. It never does, but I keep hoping it does. That's part of it. So it's kind of like only way to go is up from there, especially when you consider all the off-the-field stuff that team encountered. But yeah, he inherited a pretty good group. Their success is going to be based on, can he develop a QB, and can this offensive line be any good after it returns all five of its starters for the second time?
Will, appreciate the time. We'll catch up with you as the season goes along.
Hey, man, appreciate you having me on.
Scott Rabelais here. LSU might be the most compelling story in the league this year based on there's not a lot of drama yet with LSU. There's drama in year two with Ed Orgeron, which I don't know is completely fair to him, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah, there's just so many question marks on the team. You have LSU is one of the few teams in the conference that doesn't have anyone back with any kind of returning quarterback starts. You have brought in the transfer Joe Burrow, but we'll see how he does. He beats out the other guys. Question marks at running back after years with Fournette and Geis. Now you have no one dependable there, depending on some newcomers at receiver. The defense should be good. They fought off Texas A&M to try to keep Dave Aranda as defensive coordinator, but just a really difficult schedule. Playing both teams in the national championship game, two of the teams that were in New Year's Six bowls, Miami and Auburn, Miss State, who beat them by 30 last year, and going to A&M, who's a team that you figure is going to be improved, though they haven't beaten LSU since they joined the league. So it could go a lot of different ways, but. And I would say, on balance, Ed Orgeron's seat is warm. I don't think it's hot, but I think it can be warm this year.
With Ole Miss, we keep looking at the schedule and saying that Texas Tech game, if they're going to get to six or seven wins, is so big. When I was looking at LSU's schedule, that Miami game at the beginning could sort of set the stage in so many ways. I mean, a win takes some of the warmth out of the seat, lets them relax a little. A loss, it's not the end of the world, but it sets the stage potentially for a first half that gets a little rocky. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, he's Miami at the Cowboys Stadium, then they come over and play Southeastern Louisiana to the game they should win, and then they go to Auburn. So, if they don't win the Miami game, a 1-2 start is very possible. And then you start talking about the team's confidence and momentum and where they are with that. And you figure there's going to be some growing pains with the new offense. You have a new offensive coordinator, Steve Insminger, who ran the offense 2 years ago after Les Miles was fired, but was the tight ends coach last year. Now he's running the offense again full time. You have to make some changes. I know everybody always hears about LSU, going to pass the ball more, but they really kind of by necessity you're going to have to pass the ball more this year. And there'll be some things you have to work through with that, and it's just a tough way to start. Yeah, it's going to be Yeah, I think it's a huge – every opener is big, but this is going to be a huge game against a team that a lot of people say will be in the top 10.
What did you make of the recruitment of Joe Burrow? When you saw the other quarterbacks in the spring, what's the feeling of – I mean, obviously he's going to be the quarterback. They brought him in to be the quarterback. He's going to win the job. What's the feeling of the other quarterbacks? What's going to happen with those guys? And how good does Burrow have to be? Like you mentioned, there's no proven running back. There is no Leonard Fournette or Darius Geis there this year. How good does Burrow have to be almost immediately for this team to meet expectations?
Yeah, they do have a good defense to rely on, I think. You know, but he's going to have to deliver a lot. He's going to have to be able to complete the passes and make the right reads and get them in the right checks and all those things in an offense that he hasn't been in that the other guys have been in. Like you said, I agree that he's almost certain to be the quarterback because they brought him in. I'm a little surprised at this point that all three of the other quarterbacks who were coming back are still on the team. I thought especially Justin McMillan, the junior, who probably looked the best of anyone in the spring, although he's considered the least talented. It hasn't left for an FCS school or something like that. But I would imagine someone's going to leave at some point. I guess it could still happen, you know, before the season starts, so I guess it's not likely. But, yeah, there's a lot on him. There's a lot on Burrow, who came from Ohio State, lost out on the quarterback battle there to replace JT Barrett and just hasn't – just was kind of got hurt and got kind of got behind and was not able to overcome and get that starting job and left after spring football. So there's a lot on him, but he's also probably the most talented and has some experience in playing there. I would have thought by now Miles Brennan would be the guy, but I don't think he's progressed the way they wanted. And Lowell Narcisse, who always just seems like he doesn't have good accuracy, so good runner. But it's always a lot on the quarterback, obviously. But Burrow's got a particular set of challenges facing him.
Was Steve Ensminger the guy that Orgeron really wanted, or was he the guy that he ended up having to hire because maybe others were hesitant to come to Baton Rouge at this point?
You know, looking at some of the other hires he has made, you know, bringing back Jerry Sullivan, who was an LSU wide receivers coach back in the 80s and coached for a long time in the NFL, and coming back and hiring Greg McMahon, the former Saints special teams coach, to be his full-time special teams coach. Now they added the 10th assistant. That's who he wanted to know and as someone he had a relationship with. I think he wanted Steve. Like, it was clear very quickly, and I'm sure it was quickly clear for Ed, too, that the whole Matt Canada experiment was a mistake. They didn't get along personality-wise. They clashed. They certainly didn't get along philosophy-wise. And Steve, I think, is going to run the kind of offense that he wants. And he wants an offense like they had it when he was at USC under Pete Carroll, a pro-style offense with play-action pass principles. And I think you saw a lot of the play-action pass game when Steve was calling the plays back in 2016 using the Cam Cameron playbook. And that's going to be his playbook. And I think it's who he wanted. I don't think he necessarily wanted to go to anybody else. I mean, you know, there was a lot of talk that Lane Kiffin was going to come two seasons ago. And I think he would love to have had Lane then, but obviously he's not available. So barring that, I think Steve is probably as much as anyone that he would like to have.
Let's talk hot seat a little bit, because I'm just kind of curious, because I think you mentioned a couple of names there. Obviously Lane Kiffin's kind of restored his reputation to a degree, at least among the eyes of fans. He's sort of a sexy hire that looms out there for a lot of schools. Jimbo Fisher's now in the league. LSU's going to see him every year. Tom Herman was at one point looked to be LSU's next coach. He appears to be doing a good job at Texas. How much did all of that, those things sort of factor in with if things get off to a shaky start in Baton Rouge, the pressure that will be on the athletics director, Joe Oliva, on Ed Orgeron, just fan angst?
Yeah, I think there's very much a lot of in fact, I will say this, with the recruiting that's been done by Will Wade on the basketball side, I think there's more excitement for basketball and more dread for football than I've seen at LSU since Shaquille O'Neal and Chris Jackson were on the team back in, you know, like 1989, 90.
Late 80s, 90. Yeah,
yeah, so it reminds you of that, which was the tail end of the Mike Archer era, you know, before he got fired and that sort of thing. So it's that kind of feeling, although LSU's not been losing. I mean, they went to the Citrus Bowl last year and they won 9 games. So it's not like they're the program has fallen off the cliff, but it's clearly taken a step back from where it was. And the question is, LSU has clearly fallen behind where they were 10 years ago or even 6 or 7 years ago, making it to the national championship game against Alabama. Is Ed Orgeron the guy to lead them back? Can LSU fans envision Ed Orgeron lifting trophies and leading them to the SEC championship game and beyond, even a New Year's Six Bowl bid that, you know, a lot of other schools have achieved in the SEC that LSU has yet to do under this current format. So, but I think for this year, and I could be proven wrong, I think for this year there's more pressure on the athletic director. I think if things go awry for LSU, and awry means 6-6, or, you know, I think. And now with the schedule they have, they could go 5-7. But I think 6 or 7 wins, and that puts a lot of pressure on Ed for next year. But I think you could very plausibly see a move with the athletic director, Spider, with Oliva, who, like a lot of athletic directors, is not the most popular guy. He has not done a lot to help himself in terms of publicity and public relations. And certainly the feel is he will not be allowed to make the next hire if the next hire has to be made.
Give me your pecking order for the SEC West. If you had to forecast it today, how does it end up?
Alabama first, Auburn State third. I guess I'll go with A&M fourth because LSU has to go there to go to College Station to end the season. LSU fifth, Ole Miss, and Arkansas.
So you've got LSU somewhere in the 7-5, 8-4 range in your mind?
I think I have right now, not having seen the offense or seen what Burrow can do in this offense. As we talked about, I think I have to say with the tough schedule, 7-5 is what I would say right now. They can win the Miami game. They could win 8. And 9, though, is the absolute ceiling, I think. It's just too tough a schedule and too many question marks for LSU. I don't see that happening. I think 8-4 would have to be a good season. But right now, 7-5, not having seen them play, looks like the most likely scenario.
Last thing, how weird is it going to be to see Ole Miss and LSU in September?
It is. You know, it's I don't know how Ole Miss fans feel about it. I'm not really sure how a lot of LSU fans feel about it. It's kind of flip-flopping. You know, the SEC wanted some more marquee games earlier in the season, and this is a long-standing rivalry. It's still a big game for LSU and Ole Miss. I think when Ole Miss comes to LSU, whatever the sport is, some of the biggest crowds for a game, whether it's football, basketball, baseball, and I'm sure it's that way when LSU goes to Oxford. But I think it's weird. To me, it's, you know, I just think LSU, Ole Miss, you know, the last week of October. I think it should be the last week in October. Halloween night, Billy Cannon and Jake Gibbs and all those Johnny Vaught. I just think back old time. That's a game that, you know, it's like Alabama and Tennessee, so the third week in October. LSU and Ole Miss is made for the last week of October. I'm going to miss it being that time of year, but they didn't ask me about the scheduling.
Did you ever take woodshop class in high school? Were you taking a look at that trophy, the Magnolia Bowl trophy, which looks like it was maybe the winner of a high school woodshop competition? Have you ever thought maybe I could do this as a hobby?
The thing I do best with my hands is type. That's the best thing I could do. But I think I might have done a little better. Yeah, it's like it looks like it won like some kind of high school, you know, contest. I got an A though, you know, I'm on this. I mean, you have that, and you have the boot, the LSU Arkansas trophy, which is the biggest, most garish, heaviest trophy it has to be in college football, because it's like this gold plated monstrosity. So does anyone call it the Magnolia Bowl? I don't know. I just like, really, it needs a name? It doesn't. All you need to say is go to hell LSU, go to hell Ole Miss, and I think you're good. You know, I don't think you need a trophy that looks like, yeah, it came from an 11th grade, you know, project.
So we just renamed it, called the Go to Hell Bowl, and that'd be they had the Go Daddy Bowl. The Go to Hell Bowl would be set.
Perfect. Yeah, that's all you need. You know, it's just clean. They call Georgia Tech clean old fashioned. Hey, LSU Ole Miss is not too far behind, and you know, the players at the LSU Arkansas game, they race over to get the trophy. I don't think anybody races to get the Magnolia Bowl when LSU Ole Miss wins.
Scott, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
We take a break from the podcast to tell you that the podcast is brought to you in part by Billy's Pecans. Guests join us throughout the week on the Billy's Pecans hotline. Check out their selection of pecans. It's the cinnamon spice pecans are fantastic. My favorite, the toasted pecans. simple, but you just can't beat them. Dark chocolate, white chocolate, chocolate amaretto, chocolate Grand Marnier, and more. They also have other things, all sorts of goodies, pecans and chocolate, southern pecan toffee, cheese crispies, pecan brittle, coffee cakes, sauces, jellies, and more. All of that at Billy's Pecans. It's billyspecans.com or 1-800-624-7404. The podcast also brought to you by Oxford University Bank. OUB, locally owned and operated right here in Oxford. When you deposit money at OUB, that money and the vast majority of the bank's profits go right back into the Oxford community. OUB gives you the comfort of home, all the benefits the big mega banks provide, all the technology and products you can want, all with the personal touch. When you call OUB, you speak directly with the live person, all without having to press 10 buttons, all without that 5-minute wait. OUB offers its customers the absolute best cash checking account. It's called Kasasa. And with Kasasa, OUB will pay customers 2.5% interest on their balances up to $50,000. With Kasasa, ATM fees nationwide are refunded. Also, OUB offers online bill pay and mobile check deposit using its online app. To learn more about OUB, check out liveoxfordbankoxford.com or call 662-234-6668. OUB is FDIC insured. And the podcast is brought to you by 7 South Tailgating. 7 South celebrating 10 years of business this season. If you try 7 South Tailgating once, you'll never tailgate without them again. 7 South will set up your own personal gear, or you can rent everything from them. No one matches their customer service, their attention to detail. Whether you're coming up for one game, just all of the SEC games, or you're coming up for all of the games, and whether you have a very intricate tailgate or the simplest of tailgates, 7 South Tailgating can hook you up, make the process of tailgating in the Grove far more enjoyable than having to do it yourself. 7SouthTailgating.com. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
Josh Kendall of the State joins us on the podcast. I was telling you a minute ago before we started, I'm high on South Carolina, like not to win the championship, but to be a really good team. I think they might be the one team in the league that people are sleeping on the most.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, they are a solid number two in the East. I don't think when you look at their schedule, the problem from South Carolina's perspective is their two most hated rivals, Georgia and Clemson, are among the four best teams in the country. And I don't think they challenge either of those teams this year. But you look at everything else on their schedule, and I think Carolina could conceivably be a Vegas favorite and could conceivably win all of those games. You have a 10-win regular season. You could have a 10-win regular season in Columbia, which is rare.
I miss this because it certainly appears that Dabo Swinney has turned Clemson into an elite power. There's no end in sight. If anything, they're only improving as a program. They've become a very attractive school to recruits, all of those things. How has that changed the way South Carolina is as a program? And how does it change the way Will has to approach his program? How does it change the way the fans feel about that dynamic?
Well, you know, South Carolina fans love nothing more in the history than that 5-game winning streak over Clemson. I mean, that for them was better than beating the Wisconsins and the Michigans, et cetera, in bowl games, almost maybe better than playing in the SEC championship game in 10 because they got crushed so bad by Auburn. Those 5 wins against Clemson were a big deal to Carolina people. And now you're looking at Clemson on the verge of getting their own 5-game winning streak, and like you say, showing no signs of slowing. So you look at a Carolina team that went from 3 wins to 6 wins to 9 wins. That's really good progress, and that's the kind of stuff that fan base can get excited about. But the Gamecock fans can't get too excited because they keep bumping their head on Clemson. And I think Georgia factors into that too, because it's the same thing. You know, for Carolina people, Georgia is the team they want to beat second worst every year. And they're just not real close to those teams right now. So Will has to constantly live in that, not necessarily shadow of Clemson, but he has to answer the Clemson question. And he answers it the same way every time. We're worried about us, we're focused on what we do, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Carolina can continue to build and move in the right direction with Clemson where they are, but Carolina people can't ever be happy with Clemson, under Clemson's thumb, which they are right now.
I was telling you, watching from afar, Will Muschamp certainly looks a lot more comfortable at South Carolina than he did at Florida. Just the way that he handles press things, the way that he looks on the sideline, even press conferences, that kind of thing. Is that just me oversimplifying it, or am I onto something?
No, I think you're absolutely right. He is a grinder. You look back on his career, he's a walk-on at Georgia, turned starter and team captain. He fits better at a place like Carolina, where you grind your way to 8 or 9 wins and people are really appreciative, than a place like Florida, where you have a lot of built-in advantages and 8 or 9 wins can be a down year. So I think that Will feels more comfortable in his own skin, and Will learned a lot in his time at Florida. And thirdly, I think Jake Bentley doesn't get enough credit for being a really good, he's not a great SEC quarterback, but he's good to really good guy. And I think he's a stabilizing force that Will's Florida team's never had in terms of just a quarterback you can count on. He's not necessarily wasn't a five-star recruit, not a guy who's going to be in line for any national awards probably at the end of the year. He's a really good quarterback.
Along those lines, take me through, just give me the abridged version, offense, defense. What's the strengths, the weaknesses of the South Carolina team?
Offensively, it's Bentley, and it's Debo Samuel and Brian Edwards. Debo Samuel returns after playing two and three-quarters games last year. He was one of the most dynamic players in the SEC, and I think he'll be that this year. Scored 6 touchdowns in 11 quarters of football last year. Brian Edwards, I think, is the best number 2 wide receiver in the Southeastern Conference. So between those two guys and Bentley, they should be able to throw the ball. Brian McClendon comes in and says he is fully committed now to a more up-tempo offense, at least in times. I think they want to be more multi-tempo than up-tempo. Defensively, they'll be okay. The good news is they have a couple of difference makers on the front level in the front 7. Javon Kinlaw, defensive tackle, who is potentially one of these guys who you could see as a top 5 NFL draft pick in the future. He's got that kind of girth, got that kind of athletic ability. T.J. Brunson at middle linebacker is a really good player, an all-SEC type guy. The bad news is you don't surround them with a lot of experience. South Carolina might have to play in heavy rotation, 3 true freshmen on the defensive line. That's not good news. Sky Moore is gone at linebacker. So Will and Treveris Robinson have earned some benefit of the doubt on defense, but they're going to have to, they're going to have to coach these guys up.
How are they recruiting there, given kind of what we just talked about? Georgia, Clemson, both recruiting just plethoras of 4 and 5-star players. Can South Carolina, is it conceivable that they can compete at that level in recruiting?
No, not consistently. What South Carolina has to do is rely more than Georgia and Clemson. They have to rely on what South Carolina is producing each year, because Clemson can go out to Florida and almost nationally and fill in when the state of South Carolina has a down year recruiting. Georgia is always going to have Georgia, which is going to have few down years recruiting, and they can recruit nationally to some degree. South Carolina is going to have a tough time ever recruiting nationally. So they are at the mercy kind of the cyclical depth of talent in the state of South Carolina. Will will always recruit South Carolina well. He'll always evaluate very well and develop guys very well. But I don't, I don't think South Carolina can make a living saying we're going to go head-to-head against Clemson for a bunch of 5-stars. Carolina doesn't win that battle. They've just got to keep chipping away at that block. This year's a bad year in South Carolina. Next year's a pretty good year, so they need to hit those years where there's a lot of talent in the state. They need to get their share.
I suspect your knowledge of Ole Miss is similar to mine of South Carolina. It's almost kind of distance-based.
Right.
South Carolina comes to Oxford this year. I know fans get excited about the Grove and all of that stuff. From your perspective, what do you see, obviously, the Ole Miss program coming out of all the NCAA stuff? When you look at that, obviously, I would think South Carolina looks at that game as, hey, that's one we should win, one we need to win. When you look at that Ole Miss program from a distance, what do you see?
I see a lot of – I see a team that could be dangerous offensively. I see a quarterback who I think is really good, and A.J. Brown, obviously, is very good. I think Carolina people don't know what to think. Carolina people are not ever going to look at anybody and say – oh, yeah, we're going to go over there and beat them necessarily. It's just not in 100 years of their historical nature. But they don't know what to expect. And I think that they'll start to pay attention to Ole Miss as the season begins and see where they're headed. But they are excited about coming to the Grove. They are excited about coming to Oxford in a place they don't get too much.
Do you like the 6-1-1, or do you think it's one of these deals where it's protecting a couple of rivalries? And, Ole Miss and South Carolina won't play each other again for, 6 years?
Right. I think – the 6-1-1, the 7-2, whatever, throw all that out. And I'm a no divisions guy. just get rid of divisions and play it in one lump. Then you can have a rotation where you protect all those traditional rivals, where you get to places more often than every, whatever, 9 years or 12 years or whatever it is now. So I'm not for tinkering with the divisional schedules. If you're going to tinker anymore, just get rid of the divisions and do one lump.
It'd be interesting. So you take the top two teams and put them in the championship game? Because
yes.
The championship game's not going away because it's
right.
a cash
it's
cow.
Too much, money. Yeah. You just take the top two teams. I mean, in theory, people say, well, you know, what if you played Alabama-Auburn back-to-back weeks? I can't imagine anybody would complain if they were the two best teams in the South.
Yeah, that would mean they were both good. You'd still
right.
get great ratings.
Right. And it's a rematch and it's a revenge game no matter who won the first time. So, yeah, I don't see – The potential for that sort of rematch downside is much lower than the benefits from my perspective.
Last couple of things. You obviously have Georgia 1, South Carolina 2. What's the rest of the East look like? There's no team in the rest of the East that is, at least on paper when you look at it, looks like a team that has even a chance to be a dominant special type of team.
Right. Probably I would pick Florida 3rd because – they've got a baseline, I think, of talent there. Dan comes into a situation where he's at least knows a little bit about the program. He's got some experience from Mississippi State. So I think Florida's 3rd. I think Tennessee's a train wreck. I think Vanderbilt's a train wreck. I think Kentucky is, you know, the great Kentucky resurgence that we've been hearing about is not coming. So you know, Missouri, I don't have any belief that they're going to be much better. So I think it is a 2.5-team division. And the half depends on what the Gators do.
I agree with you about Tennessee. I'm curious whether you think it's a long-term train wreck or do you think Jeremy Pruitt has any chance at all to turn it around?
I don't know. I can't see the future. If I had to bet, I'd bet no. I would bet that his what we know of his personality will not do well in the years that are coming because the years that are coming will be lean and will be frustrating and will be – you know, they love him now. They won't when he's 6-7 or 5-8 or whatever. You know, how will he handle that? From what we've seen, I don't know how well he'll handle that. So I would bet more toward no than yes. But we'll see.
Last thing, you said South Carolina on paper could go 10-2. If you, Josh Kendall, had the gun put to your head, you had to pick the record, where would you go?
I wouldn't go 10-2 regular season. 9-4 after a bowl would match last year. I think that's not necessarily a safe bet, but I think that's a good landing spot for this team. I think they could be 10-3 after a bowl game. They are not – it's hard to believe that they will win all of everything else other than Georgia and Clemson. It's hard to believe that they'll run that table. So I would say 9-3, and depending on what kind of bowl matchup you get, I think this is a 9-win team again.
Josh, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Jason Caldwell of Inside the Auburn Tigers joins. I guess when I think of Auburn, I think about two things. I think of the end of the season, how good they looked against Georgia, and how great they looked against Alabama, and then how poor they looked against Georgia, and how, I don't know, disinterested perhaps they looked against Central Florida. So which Auburn was the real Auburn?
I think it's probably, like most everything, I think it's probably somewhere in between. Obviously, when you get a chance to play Georgia and Alabama and you play them at home, that is a big factor and a big deal. And you could see that was an Auburn team that was ready. They were ready for those games. And you've been to Jordan-Hare Stadium a bunch of times, covered games there, covering Auburn before. That's a place when it's fired up, it is tough for the opponent to win. And you saw that last year. I think you kind of factor those in. And then you look at the injury to Kerryon Johnson late in that Alabama game, how much that factored in, especially to the Georgia game, because there was only 1 week in between. That had a profound impact because he was a guy that carried the load in the running game for Auburn. And Gus Malzahn's offense, I mean, Jarrett Stidham had a great year, but it was predicated on being able to run the football and do those things. And even then, you know, that was a one-possession game late in the third quarter. So it kind of fell apart late. And then after that, you're right, disinterested. You can tell yourself all day long that, hey, we're fired up, we're ready to go, we're excited about UCF, but you're never going to be as excited as they are. And you can see that in that game as it wore on. So I think it was somewhere in between, but I think what it did was it showed, and I think this team felt like that, okay, now we've once again shown that we're right there with those teams, But now you got to go prove it again, because once again you headed to another year, and everybody kind of says it's Alabama, Georgia, and everybody else in the league. So for Auburn, you're going, well, here we are again. Let's see if we can make another run late in the season.
This time last year, we were talking about Gus Malzahn on the hot seat. Did he have to beat Georgia and or Alabama to get off the hot seat? You knew there was a decent chance Arkansas would open up and they would be interested in Malzahn. And he wins those games. Arkansas was interested in Malzahn, but he gets the big deal, stays at Auburn 7 years, I think $49 million. Does having that boogaboo off of his back, at least for a little while, take some of the pressure off of him, or is it still intensified because of the way the season ended?
I think it's intensified because you're in the state with who you're in the state with. When your rival is a team that everybody in the country is kind of chasing, it puts that automatic pressure on you. There's no question about it. I think it takes some of the pressure off in that you know the stability's there. You're solid in your job and doing what you're doing. And so because of that, I think you look and seeing that you're stable. And in this league, stability is something that's not a good option for a lot of people. There's a lot of turnover in this league. So knowing that you're there, you got your assistant coaches in place, all those things, I think it's allowed him to, as much as he can, relax, because he's not a guy that relaxes a whole lot. But I think you can sense a little bit different Gus Malzahn now.
So I know everyone talks about Jared Stidham and all the things that Jared Stidham can do, and he is an awfully good quarterback. But when I think of Auburn, I think of running backs, and you mentioned Kerryon Johnson was so good a year ago. I think we all assume the passing game will be pretty solid. What about the running game? Who's the guy that's going to carry the load for them and give them the balance that offense has to have?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at Cam Martin's a guy that has 900 or so yards the last 2 years and has been, you know, people consider him a small back. I mean, he was probably 185, 188 pounds last year. He's up to almost 200 pounds now. And so you look and it's a little bit different type of running back than Auburn's had the last few years. But I think Cam Martin's a guy that takes on that role. I think the difference is probably the first time in a long time, and maybe the first time ever since Gus Malzahn's been at Auburn, that I don't think you have a guy that's a 25 to 30 carry a game guy. I think it's going to be more of 18 to 20, and maybe if Cam Martin gets hot, maybe to 25 once or twice. I don't think you're going to see a guy that's considered, you know, 30 carries week in and week out like we've seen the last 2 years. I think that's a good thing. I think it's hurt Auburn late in seasons. You know, Cameron Petway the season before, Kerryon Johnson last year. But if you look at it, you know, having a guy like, you know, Cam Martin kind of carry the load. And then there's some young guys that I think they're excited to see what they can do, whether it be Booby Whitlow or Asa Martin, a true freshman. They've got some options, just not a whole lot of experience at all behind Cam Martin.
What is the next step for Jared Stidham? What does he have to do to take that next step as a quarterback?
I think it's probably take more control of the offense. That's what we haven't seen. I think it's going to be really the next step in his progression in this offense. And with Chip Lindsey coming in last year, this offense looks a little different. You know, we saw more of the RPOs, and I think that's an extension of the running game that we may see more of this year, because of the fact that you don't have a guy that, you know, you're counting on to be a huge, you know, ball carrier. I think the RPOs, Jared Stidham taking more control and probably maybe more in the red zone. Last year, you know, you get the red zone, it's Kerryon Johnson time. I think more, like, there's more throws in the end zone in the red zone this year, and maybe you have, I mean, 18 touchdowns for an Auburn quarterback is a pretty good number, but I think you can see that, you know, up a pretty good bit this year.
I feel stupid that I can't break down their defense at this point, because I just don't know. You do. You've seen them. How good of a defense is this?
I think the front seven is as good as Auburn's had in a long time. There's depth. There's talent there. And you depend on those guys to help out a younger secondary. You lose your two safeties, two veteran guys, a corner that's going to be playing in the NFL with the Bucs and Carlton Davis. You got some guys back there, but you look up front and Dontavius Russell and Derrick Brown, Marlon Davidson, Nick Coe, Tadarian Moultrie, Big Cat Bryant. I mean, this is a loaded defensive line group. Three senior linebackers back as well. So this front seven for Auburn can stack up with anybody. And if they can play up to that level, they can help that young secondary grow. But you got to do it right out of the gate, because when you face Washington in the season opener, you know, you're going to have that challenge right out of the gate. So this is a team that is going to rely on that front seven, especially early.
What's your picture of the SEC West? It's obviously Alabama's at the top. Auburn's right there. And there's a lot of question marks. Mississippi State, I think we all think A&M will be better, but we don't know how much better.
Arkansas, Ole Miss are rebuilding. I mean, it's a very top-heavy division, at least on paper.
It is, and you look, and I think this league, you're right, there's quite huge question marks, because when you look at, you know, people, kind of everybody throwing Mississippi State out there right now, but you go, you know, new system, quarterback coming off injury, and a system that relies on throwing the football a lot more. Nick Fitzgerald hasn't done a ton of that. Texas A&M, Jimbo Fisher is a quarterback-centered offense. Question mark at quarterback, whether it's Nick Stark or Kellen Mond. There's issues there. Arkansas, a completely new system without the players to run it. Ole Miss, you look and you go, offensively, that team off the charts offensively, scoring. Can they slow down people enough to stay in games in the fourth quarter, do those things? But you look at Alabama. The one thing I question about them is what happens if the quarterback situation goes haywire a little bit. Everything's always kind of worked out great, but what happens if you go with Tua, you know, Jalen Hurts says, I'm going somewhere else, and then Tua turns into Jeremy Johnson. You know, a guy that, hey, he played one good half of football, but that's all we've seen of him. Now what happens? So there's question marks. They've got the most talent. There's no question. Auburn, you're sitting there going, okay, can you stay healthy at the quarterback position? LSU, once again, grad transfer quarterback. What happens with him? Do they have a running back that can take over? New offensive coordinator again. There's a ton of questions in that in the West, and because of that, you go, who's the ones that can challenge and take that step up? Because I do think that, especially 3 and 4, I think 3 and 4 are up for grabs in this league. If Auburn can do what they can do and compete with Alabama, everybody else is right there, I think, together, maybe with the exception of Arkansas, to be that next team.
Long term, when I say long term, next 5 years, if Georgia does what it looks like they're going to do, which is become an elite program, and Alabama stays where Alabama's been for the last decade, Auburn's done a great job of finding a way to still get talent and stay there. Is that something that Gus has figured out? Has it been serendipity? I mean, how has he been able to keep his niche with Alabama and Georgia dominating recruiting the way that they have?
Yeah, I think the key has been that you continue to recruit Alabama and Georgia, because you look at those two teams, because of what they've done, have gone out and got guys nationally. Auburn's always been a program that's relied on local, that know the fabric of Auburn, that know the program, the history. So that they're going to continue to recruit Alabama and Georgia heavy. Probably the biggest difference this year is bringing Marcus Woodson in. Auburn has recruited Mississippi more than they ever have. I think that's something that can continue. We've seen the talent in Mississippi continue to grow. And if you can pull, you know, your 5 or 6 from Georgia, 6 or 7 from Alabama, a couple from Mississippi, a couple from Tennessee, and then your 4 or 5 from Florida. That's how Auburn competes. That's how they've always done it, and that's what they'll have to continue to do.
Jason, appreciate the time. Look forward to seeing you in Oxford later in the fall.
Sounds good. Thanks.
We take a break from the show to tell you that the podcast is brought to you by Gambrell & Associates. Gambrell & Associates have 3 attorneys with more than 60 years of combined experience and more than 45 years handling only bankruptcy and Social Security disability claims. Check out their site, msbnkr.com, or by searching for Robert Gambrell on superlawyers.com or avvo.com. Super Lawyers only selects the top 5% of lawyers in the state, so you know you're getting a great one when you get Robert Gambrell. Gambrell & Associates handle Social Security disability claims statewide and in Memphis. For more information, call the office in Hernando at 662-342-7700 or in Oxford at 662-281-8800. The podcast is also brought to you by Grenada Nissan. If you're in the market for a Nissan vehicle, look no further than Grenada Nissan. Grenada Nissan has a complete selection of new and previously owned Nissan vehicles. Great lease deals as well. Go in, test drive one today. Tell Gene and Sandy that you heard about Grenada Nissan on the podcast or at rebelgrove.com. You'll get Rebel savings on top of the already great deals at Grenada Nissan. It's GrenadaNissanUSA.com. The podcast also brought to you by Harry Alexander. Harry is an Oxford-based RE/MAX Legacy Realty agent. He's been in Oxford more than 4 decades, and no one knows the residential and condo market better than Harry does. If you are in the market for a home or a condo in or around Oxford, go to his site, harryalexander.com, click on the Properties and Neighborhoods tab, filter through by what you're looking for. The results that you see are updated daily, and then you just send Harry an email. He'll take care of the rest. ha@harryalexander.com. And Rebel Nation, 2018 is the year of the fan. Ole Miss Athletics wants to showcase your stories and recognize you, the Ole Miss fan base. Exciting prizes and experiences throughout the year will be featured on omyearofthefan.com and updated often, so be sure to visit omyearofthefan.com. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
Here with the legendary Bob Holt of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. You just got a shout out from Barry Odom of Missouri. Probably the only media member here who gets his own personal shout out.
Yeah, well, I think Barry knows I'm a Mizzou grad. I really like Barry. I like most of the coaches. They're good guys to deal with. And but yeah, it's nice to be noticed, I guess.
You're one of those guys who I'm almost the opposite. I'm almost never involved on the teleconferences. You do it. Is it just, do you go in with a plan, or do you just kind of ad lib it?
Probably some of both. I mean, I usually have a couple stories I'm working on. You know, we do a lot of stuff on the opponent. You know, we might be different in that we do a lot of opponent stuff. You know, whoever Arkansas might be playing that week, or, you know, I feel like, hey, on that teleconference, you got to kind of, you know, mine it and maybe save it for later. So I might be asking about a certain player and thinking for a story 2 or 3 weeks down the line. You think, well, I may not be able to get that many questions into this guy. So, yeah, I usually have a couple stories I'm working on. And we also do an SEC report every week that runs on Thursdays. So I'm always trying to ask stuff of those guys for things for the report. So, sometimes they'll say something, or, you know, somebody smarter than me will be asking some good questions of the coaches earlier, and I'm like, well, that's a pretty good idea for a story. So I'll piggyback on that and start asking some things, you know, that just come to mind, you know, during the course of the teleconference.
All right, we'll flip to Arkansas. I'll go here. Why did Brett Bielema fail? He's a really good coach. He won at Wisconsin. It certainly appeared that he had a plan and that all of those things. Why did it not work?
You know, it worked to a certain degree. It just kind of all fell apart there. You know, I think he didn't recruit Texas well, and that's a big issue at Arkansas. And I know Arkansas is obviously not in the Southwest Conference anymore with all the Texas schools, but that's a neighboring state. Dallas is, you know, a pretty short drive. Just a lot of players in the state of Texas, and so he and his staff probably didn't recruit Texas well enough, and that's something Arkansas is looking for Chad Morris to hopefully, for Arkansas's sake, take care of, do a better job with that. I think losing Sam Pittman, I know he's one coach, but I think that was a huge loss. You know, he's the offensive line coach, who's at Georgia now. I don't think it's a coincidence Georgia won the SEC championship with Sam as the offensive line coach. He was a really good coach. He was a really good recruiter. They had linemen from all over the country. You know, Frank Ragnow, who was a first-round pick of the Lions, came from Minnesota. They had Dan Skipper, who is on the Lions. I think he may be on the Lions, too. He's on the practice squad with somebody. He came from Colorado. They had guys from all over. They had Denver Kirkland, came from Florida. He's with the Raiders now, I think. So when they lost Sam, that was huge. You know, when he first went to Arkansas, he was so highly thought of. Like, he'd been at Arkansas months. Nick Saban tried to hire him, and Sam got a big raise out of it, so good for him. But I think that really hurt him, you know, losing. Because that Brett's identity of his teams was about being real physical in the trenches, having a big offensive line. You know, if you remember a couple years ago, they had the offensive line was on the cover of the media guide. And so I think losing Sam really hurt a lot. You know, one thing about Brett was very good coach. He is a very good coach. He did great at Wisconsin, but he basically took over for Barry Alvarez and, you know, took over a program that was in very good shape. Brett took over a program that was basically, you know, a dumpster fire after what Petrino crashed and burned, literally, and John L. Smith obviously didn't work out very well. So I'll give credit for Brett. You know, he left the program in better shape than he found it. I think he was able to he was pushing that boulder up the mountain, so to speak, and I think he got it so far. I don't know if he kind of wore out physically and mentally. But after, you know, his best recruiting class may have been his first one, which, because you look at Alex Collins was in that. It was with, you know, the Ravens now, and then Denver Kirkland. He had a skipper, a lot of really good players in that class. And it just seemed like the recruiting fell off after that. And also, I think literally half of Brett's games, like 30-some of his games, were against ranked teams. So I think he came into the West, the SEC and the West in particular, at a really tough time, because obviously Alabama's got it going, the Mississippi schools. You know, obviously Ole Miss fell off last year, but the Mississippi schools have been very good. LSU's been really good. Auburn's been good. A&M getting in the league didn't help Arkansas. And they really have owned Arkansas. Arkansas has lost like three overtime games. So I think it was a combination of the it was hard to sustain the recruiting. He had he had a lot of turnover in his coaching staff, especially losing Sam Pittman was big. And I think, you know, maybe just playing 30-some ranked teams in 5 years, you know, I mean, averaging six ranked teams a year, that's a tough deal. So I think it was a kind of a combination of all that that ultimately got Brett. But, you know, they reached a certain plateau, you know, 8 wins. You know, they won some, you know, they beat Kansas State in a bowl game. That's obviously a good win. And they killed Texas. Granted, a bad Texas team, but that's always big in Arkansas to beat Texas, especially like that. But then after that, they just couldn't sustain it. And, you know, I think a lot of that was maybe just a tough schedule, too.
So you talked about how he did not leave him a dumpster fire. He left him some players. He left him some stability inside that program. Chad Morris, a completely different scheme, a completely different sort of coach. How difficult or awkward do you think the transition will or will not be from Bielema to Morris once the season rolls around?
I think it's a tough transition because Brett, you know, I mean, with Dan Enos, who's now at Alabama, and you know, they became more pass-oriented, and they even ran a little hurry-up at times last year. But Brett actually, if you recall, he was basically came out publicly against the hurry-up, you know, talking about it was dangerous for players, and clearly, you know, he wasn't a hurry-up guy. And so he didn't recruit to that. They wanted big, beefy linemen and power backs and things like that. And so Chad's come in, and they want the offensive. Chad said something before the spring game. They wanted to set an Arkansas record for most plays in a spring game, which I'm thinking, who even knows what the record for that is, you know? But afterwards, Chad and Joe Craddock, the offense coordinator, both said, well, that wasn't fast enough. We need to get better at that. I know they wanted Cole Kelly, the quarterback, to lose about 20 pounds. You know, he's kind of a big guy. And they definitely wanted the offensive lineman to lose weight, although Yelta Froholtz said here at Media Days that, you know, he's maintained his weight. And Yelta's obviously not a guy that's got much, you know, body fat. I mean, a lineman needs some body fat, obviously. But so, yeah, it's been a transition physically, especially for the linemen. I think the players were getting tired a lot during spring practice. Maybe they were getting better at that by the end of spring. So, yeah, it's a big transition physically and really mentally to think like that, you know, and it's a big adjustment for the defense because they're probably going to have to be on the field more. And so, yeah, it's a big adjustment. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out because you're talking about really a radical change in offensive philosophy.
It certainly looks like he's gotten especially the in-state kids excited about the program, really looking hard at Arkansas. How much success does he have on the field, on the scoreboard to get those kinds of kids to, you know, I'll pull the trigger to get the program momentum from a recruiting standpoint?
Well, I think it's real important. I mean, they got to go out and win 10 games, but it would be huge for them if they could get to 6 wins and get to a bowl game. I mean, I know everybody wants to play for, you know, nobody says, well, our goal for the season is to win 6 games, but that's a realistic goal for Arkansas. I'm not saying it's going to be easy to do it by any stretch of the imagination, but they do have a manageable schedule. They have a lot of home games. They got to go to Colorado State, which that would be a tougher game than most people think. And the reason they're playing Colorado State home and home is because Michigan dropped them for Notre Dame, and they had to scramble to find an opponent. But, you know, they get Vanderbilt in Fayetteville. They get Ole Miss and Little Rock. Those are winnable games. I'm not saying they're going to win them, but if they can beat Colorado State, I think they got a decent shot to get to 6. And that obviously would be huge because that means you get another month, you know, like almost like another spring practice for your team. And that gives recruits momentum because all the kids, you know, this day, with this many bowl games, I mean, if you don't go to a bowl game, it's obviously a disappointing season. I've lost track of like 40 bowl games now or 37.
Yeah, it's a ton.
It's a lot. So, yeah, getting to a bowl game would really be huge for recruiting. But I tell you what, these guys, they go after it hard. They're very big into social media, which obviously the kids are doing a lot of that these days. And so, and Chad, you know, he coached in Texas for 16 years, had a lot of success. He's got a good rapport with the coaches there. That doesn't mean they're going to get 5-star guys that Texas is going after, A&M's going after, or OU's going after. But I do think he's going to really increase their recruiting presence and success in Texas, and that's really critical for Arkansas.
You mentioned Cole Kelly. Is he the guy? And do they have the offensive weapons this year to do a lot of what Morris wants to do in terms of the passing game?
Yeah, I don't, you know, Cole Kelly is the one quarterback on campus with starting experience. He started, you know, he was forced to start last year when Austin Allen got injured. Cole could be the guy. He's got a big arm. He definitely does not lack confidence. He actually is a pretty decent runner, although, like I say, they want him to slim down some. But they had this Steamboat package they put in last year. Actually started in the A&M game when they had an open date, and they put Cole in there, and they had some designed run plays. They called the Steamboat package because he was like a Louisiana Steamboat because he's from the state of Louisiana. But he could be the guy, Ty Story, who's a guy from Charleston, Arkansas, who had very little playing time, just a few snaps. But he's a pretty good combo run passer. He played this offense in high school. Cole's probably more of a classic drop-back passer. And those guys got pretty even reps in the spring, and even reps in the spring game. And so, you know, the coaches haven't tipped their hand at all about who they're thinking of. And some, Connor Nolan, who's from Greenwood, Arkansas, it's the same high school as Tyler Wilson, all-SEC quarterback for Arkansas a few years ago, is from a very successful high school program. You know, some fans want him to be the guy. I've told people, hey, if Connor Nolan has to be the starting quarterback in the SEC as a true freshman, that's not going to be good for him. It's not going to be good for the program. So, we've asked Chad about it. He said he's not ruling anybody out. And he also stressed, hey, whoever starts the first game, that doesn't mean, you know, they've got a contract to start the rest of the year. So it's pretty wide open. And I certainly would think it would be Kelly or Story, but I don't think either of those guys, just because Kelly has got an edge, I think, because he's got starting experience, but it wouldn't shock me if Story was the guy. I think it's very even right now.
Ole Miss goes to Little Rock, as you mentioned, to play Arkansas. That's been a crazy series the last few years. Arkansas has found ways to win crazy game after crazy game after crazy game against Ole Miss. How's the atmosphere different for Arkansas now when it's at War Memorial as opposed to when it's in Fayetteville? And why move a conference game there?
Well, that's been a big debate in Arkansas. It's been called the Great Stadium Debate. Of course, you know, people know their Arkansas history. Arkansas used to play more games in Little Rock. It was kind of like an Alabama situation where Alabama used to play more games in Birmingham. Now they don't play any games in Birmingham. And Arkansas has kind of gradually cut back on games in Little Rock as they've enlarged the stadium. It's hard to believe. When I first went to Arkansas in the early 80s and started covering Arkansas, the Razorback Stadium was like 40,000 people. The big shootout, 69, if people are old enough, number one Texas, number two Arkansas, Richard Nixon came in the helicopter. George W. Bush was there as a congressman. The 40,000, like 42,000 people, that's all it said. And Little Rock said about 55, so it was a bigger stadium. Well, it still seats 55, and now Razorback Stadium seats about 72 or 3. And obviously, it had all the bells and whistles with all the skyboxes and the gigantic scoreboard and all that. So there's a faction of people think, hey, play all your games on campus. There's another faction say, hey, if it weren't for Little Rock, Arkansas wouldn't have the statewide program it does. There's a lot of fans on there. And it's not like they're – I think Birmingham and Tuscaloosa are, what, about an hour away? It's 3 hours from Little Rock. Plus, a lot of people in southern eastern Arkansas, they can drive a couple hours to Little Rock instead of driving six or seven to Fayetteville. So, a lot of people feel like they need to keep playing down there. Also, it's a student issue. If you want to get students from central Arkansas and eastern and southern Arkansas, they need to go to a Razorback game. Tommy Tuberville said this at the Northwest Arkansas Touchdown Club last year, that, you know, he thinks it's vital for Arkansas to keep playing in Little Rock, and that, as a kid who grew up in Cabinet, Arkansas, in eastern Arkansas, that, you know, he never would have been exposed to the University of Arkansas Razorbacks if he hadn't been for Little Rock. So you have people on both sides of the fence, and I think the Board of Trustees, who ultimately made the decision to keep playing games in Little Rock at least for a little bit longer, they're thinking about it from a statewide perspective, not just, you know, they don't want to be the Northwest Arkansas Razorbacks. They want to be the Arkansas Razorbacks.
Last thing, you've seen this league a long time. Alabama's dominated it for a while. When you look at the division and the way that it shapes up going into this season, is it pretty clear-cut that it's two teams at the top and everybody else chasing third and fourth, or do you think it's more wide open than that?
You're talking about Alabama and Auburn, I guess.
I would assume, yeah.
Yeah, I think Alabama's got a big advantage because they get Auburn, Tuscaloosa this year. But, yeah, because LSU's got a lot of talent, but they're young. I think A&M's got a lot of talent, but they're, you know, coaching transition, and they're young too. So I would be shocked if Alabama or Auburn didn't win the division. And I think you got to make Alabama, you know, the prohibitive favorite starting off, and we'll see what happens. But, I mean, who else in the country could have a guy with Jalen Hurts' record as a starting quarterback, and maybe he's going to be replaced? I mean, there aren't too many teams like that. It does seem like Alabama, as many guys, great players as they lose every year to the draft, they do just seem to reload.
Bob, as always, man, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.